Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined for the second part of my interview with Doug Emlin, a professor of biology at the University of Montana and an expert on the evolution and development of bizarre and extreme shapes in insects. Last time we talked about dung beetles and their strange biology and armaments. Today we'll dig deeper and talk about his research, including his many adventures doing the work from being charged by Cape Buffalo as he picks through dung on the plains of Africa, to the strange looks that airline security gives him when he comes back from his travels to far-flung places with his carry-ons just filled with dung beetles. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is the sound of an insect found in the eastern United States that feeds on cow dung. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now let me turn to the second part of my conversation on dung beetles with Doug Emlin. Dr. Emlin is a professor of biology at the University of Montana and an expert on the evolution and development of bizarre and extreme shapes in insects. While he initially resisted the idea of studying dung beetles, a failure in the field forced him to change his tune. Now he's a dung beetle aficionado, and you may be too after listening to the fascinating life of this strange group of creatures. Dr. Emlin was always interested in animal armament and became even more interested after studying a species of dung beetle in Panama that specialized in howler monkey scat. Since then, he's broadened his research to dung beetles all over the world and has noticed interesting patterns in their weaponry. Now he's focusing his research on the evolutionary forces that make animal weapons, from dung beetle horns to elk antlers to rhino horns, so diverse. In the first part of my interview, we talked about the strange biology of dung beetles and the amazing and diverse forms their horns can take. In the second part of my interview with Dr. Emlin, we'll focus on his research into the developmental and evolutionary biology of how these changes in animal forms take place. We'll talk about his many adventures doing research, from being charged by Cape Buffalo as he picks through dung on the plains of Africa, to the strange looks that airline security gives him when he comes back from his travels to far-flung places with his carry-ons filled with dung beetles. We'll also hear about how he learned to smell howler monkeys so that he could locate their first dung of the morning, and thus find the dung beetles that were the real object of his desire. We'll also talk about predatory strategies related to dung. While most predators don't use dung to find their prey, because by the time that they find the dung, the animals would be long gone, some animals, like sloths and koalas, move so slowly that they use a different strategy of burying their dung so that predators can't find them from the smell. Today you'll find out how some specialized dung beetles have adapted and hang onto the backs of the animals until the opportune moment when they drop down to be buried with their prize. When we spoke recently, I started by asking Doug about his research.
In your research on beetles, you've set up a lot of different experiments, it seems, because it sounded like you had spent a lot of time gluing little horns on little beetles and devising strength.
High-tech research here. Yes.
Devising strength challenges, you know, the Beetle Olympics or something. So I'd love to hear more about your research.
I'd be happy to go through that. One of the fun things about a system like this is that there's so much you can learn, that there's your research program can change. It can evolve over time. And what happened in my case is I started out as a gung-ho graduate student interested in doing rugged field biology, and I wanted to study these things in the wild, and I wanted to know what they did with these crazy horns, and I wanted to know why the big males had horns and the little males didn't and the females didn't. And I wanted to study the evolution of these things both by measuring the function of the horns, so what's happening in terms of selection favoring horns in the field. And I wanted to know something about the what we call the genetic architecture of the horns. What kinds of genetic variation underlie the expression of the horns that might contribute to the evolution of the horns?
So how did you undertake that research?
I started out spending a lot of years in the field, a lot of time in the tropics studying these beetles and devising ways of building sort of ant farms where we could pack the dirt in between panes of glass and actually watch these beetles as they build their tunnels and see what they do underground, because a lot of the interesting behavior is underground.
So tell me about that.
We spend a lot of time breeding them in the lab, so rearing them in captivity and trying to look at the resemblance between parents and offspring to see if we can get an index of the extent to which there's a genetic component to variation in body size or in weapon size or things like that.
And do kids look like their parents?
No, they don't.
Really?
Yeah, that was the stumbling block, one of many. But it turned out to be a really important one. So I can come back to that too. And then now most recently, we've been using a whole lot of other techniques from looking much more closely at how these beetles develop and when the horns actually grow and what kinds of factors influence the growth of the horns. And nowadays, we actually are approaching that at a genetic and what we call a genomic level. So we can start to look at physiological pathways that are crucial in the development of the horns and at particular candidate genes that we think play a role in the expression and the development of the horns. And we can start looking at when and where these things are expressed in the beetles and how do they appear to shape the horns as they grow, and how could changes in these genes contribute to a change from a branched horn to a straight horn or a head horn to a thorax horn. So we've been able to go all the way from slugging it out in the mud in the field to nowadays really looking at the level of genes and networks of genes that are involved in the development and in the evolution of these things. So it's a research program with many facets.
So let's go back to the beginning and talk a little bit about your field work.
The field work started the whole story. None of the genetic stuff would even be interesting, I would argue, unless there's natural history to go with it. And the only way to get that is actually to get out into the field and look at these things and see what they do. And they've surprised us again and again and again. So we did find, for example, that the females dig the tunnels, as we thought, as we'd read, and that the males guard these tunnels. We were able to show that the horns matter a lot. So there appears to be selection for big horns if you're a male, even though we weren't quite convinced that we could explain why in some habitats you'd have one horn type and in other places you'd have a different horn type. One of the other things that we found is that small males don't produce the horns. So I mentioned earlier there's a dimorphism, so big males have horns, small males don't, and there's really nobody in between. So there's this dichotomy. There's two types of males in these populations. And
so small males don't produce the horns.
They don't even develop with them at all. And it's not like they're going to get them later. They're not just younger. These are insects with complete metamorphosis. So they look like a grub when they're a larva. Then they go through a metamorphic period as a pupa. And then when they come out as an adult with that turtle shape, they're stuck. That's it. That's the morphology that they have for their entire life, their adult life. And so if they mature without horns, they will never have horns. And if they mature with big horns, those are the horns they're going to have for the duration. So that was the backdrop that we're working with here. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, so what determines whether a male will have horns or not?
Well, this is one of the things we can answer. But first, I got to tell you the twist. There's a twist with the behavior. The small males have an alternate mating tactic. They aren't very good at fighting for the tunnels. They're not big body sizes and they don't have the weapons. And so they can poke their heads into a tunnel, but they get clobbered by the male that's in the tunnel and they get kicked out. So one of the things that we found from watching these things in the field and from making these little ant farm type chambers and watching what they do inside the panes of glass is that the small males, if they get kicked out of a tunnel, if a big male gets kicked out of a tunnel, he waddles away and finds another tunnel and starts the whole process again and tries to plow into that one and take over that one. And they'll just keep fighting until they find a male they can beat. And then they take over the tunnel and start mating with the female and then they guard that tunnel. The small guys are different. If they get kicked out of a tunnel, which of course they do because they're tiny, they don't go running away and looking for another tunnel. They stay. They hang out near that tunnel and they dig their own tunnel right next to the main tunnel. And when they get a centimeter or so below ground, remember these are small beetles, once they get a little bit below ground, they cut horizontally and they intercept the main tunnel beneath the guarding male. It's a sneak tactic, sort of mimicking the female behavior because the females normally dig tunnels. The males don't. These little guys dig their own tunnel. They can intercept a guarded tunnel, and sometimes they get in and the big male's up at the entrance guarding or fighting with another male, and the little guy can sneak in, and they go straight down to the female, mate with the female, and leave. And it's a pretty neat alternate mating tactic. And we think, it's a harder thing to show, but we think that they do better by not having horns, by being small, by being smooth. They can slip past a guarding male or they can get in and get out faster because they're not as clumsy as the big males. And when I did this first, I found this sneaking behavior back when I was a graduate student. I was all excited and I thought, wow, now we've got an alternate mating tactic. We know what's going on. And my committee said, well, wait a minute. How do you know that it's not an artifact? You stuck these things in a glass ant farm. I mean, it's basically, it's a two-dimensional world. Where's the little guy going to go? I mean, he's got to go somewhere. He's going to go left or he's going to go right. He's got a 50-50 shot of hitting a tunnel. Maybe this is an artifact of the fact that you're watching these things in the lab and it's not something that happens in the field. So I went out into the field and I took these watered-down solutions of latex and I injected them into the tunnel. So I found real tunnels in the wild, squirted in this rubbery latex into the tunnels and let it harden. And then dug and washed away all the dirt so that we had a three-dimensional sort of architectural model of the network of tunnels underground. And what we found, first of all, is these guys really do this in the wild. There's lots of evidence of these little side tunnels, these little intercepting sneak tunnels. But what was even cooler is we found that in the field, you have such a high density of tunnels all packed in together under the dung that a single little male can trap line. He can actually cut laterally and hit 2, 3, 4, 5 different primary tunnels with a single side tunnel. So we think that these little guys are actually pretty good at this. They sneak in, get down to the female, mate, get out, go to the next tunnel, slip down to that one, try to mate, get out, go to the next one, and so on, while these big males are sitting there at the entrances trying to fight for their real estate.
Wow. So did you...
And I got to add that some work that John Hunt and Lee Simmons have done, they're and John was at Western Australia when he was working with Lee, and that's where Lee Simmons still is today. They've been able to show that these small, sneaky males, they don't have horns, but they've got bigger testes, more sperm, larger sperm, and they're more likely to transfer sperm faster when they mate. So these guys may be really good at fertilizing eggs, even if they're not so good at fighting.
Interesting.
So, isn't it? Dung beetles are amazing, aren't they?
So getting back to the research.
Okay, back to the research. So that we did stuff on behavior, but you asked what determines whether a male is a big male or a small male.
Right, but actually before that, one question was, so if you're pouring latex into this tunnel.
Yes.
And so you have this 3D model of what's happening underground. You were finding that the structure had the sneak tunnels. Were you also finding dung beetles in the latex? How did you know it was really working?
Yeah, there were some beetles that got trapped in the latex. So that is how we could verify that it was the small males that were in the small tunnels. But the other thing is that lots and lots and lots of hours of watching them in the lab, we never ever saw a big beetle make a side tunnel. We only ever saw the small guys do it. So we had pretty good, I mean, it's admittedly circumstantial, but quite a bit of evidence suggesting there's this pretty clear break in the behavior of the big males and the small males.
Wow, how
good question. Really good question.
So even if you're small, you can have alternate ways of...
Yes, you can. We don't think they do as well as the big males, but they're not doing all that badly.
If you're a male larva, what determines if you're going to be one of the big guys with horns or one of the small guys with no horns?
I started to answer that again back in grad school. What I did is I reared these things in captivity. I'd randomly pair males and females, and I would look at all their offspring. And then I would say, okay, these are offspring of males with really big horns, and these are offspring of males with little tiny horns. And I looked for a correlation. It's called a parent-offspring regression. I'm looking for a relationship between the horn lengths of the sons and the horn lengths of the fathers. And if there's a very clear inherited component to this, then you would expect that the dads with big horns would, on average, have kids, sons with big horns, and vice versa. And that's not what you find.
It's not what you find.
It's not what you find. In fact, the heritability, as we call it, was zero. I found no evidence of a resemblance between the horns of the fathers and the horns of the kids. Instead, it was all driven by nutrition. So I turned around and I did a different experiment. You take a whole bunch of kids from pairs of beetles, and I told you that they develop in these little sausage-shaped balls of dung that the females make in the dirt. Well, you can sift the dirt and get all these little sausages, these little brood balls out, and each one is a kid, right? Each one has an egg and a developing larva in it. And so I could put a pair of beetles in a container and get all the kids that they produce, and I could do this for 50 or 70 families and get all the kids that each family is producing. And then amongst those kids, I could manipulate the amount of food. I could peel off some of the dung from some of the kids so that they had really small brood balls and they didn't have very much food. And I could add some to others so that they had a lot of food. And in that way, I could artificially manipulate how much nutrition, how much food the young had when they were developing.
And how did you come up with this idea to do that?
Given the theoretical state of the field I was in at the time, that was actually a fairly logical experiment to do. I wanted specifically to tease apart the role of environmental factors like nutrition from inherited, in a traditional sense, genetic factors like parentage. And so the idea of doing what we call a split brood experiment like that's pretty common. How you do it in the dung beetles depends on the dung beetles, but since they had their food all sort of organized like that, it was pretty logical to make some of those small and to make some of them large. So I'm not going to take credit for being brilliant. It was actually pretty straightforward. But
so you're adding more dung to one ball. And
and what I found, surprise, surprise, is that if you give the dung, if you give the kids lots of food, they grow really big and they all produce horns. The males do. If you give them very small amounts of food, the males are tiny and they don't produce horns. So I could explain horn length perfectly, but it didn't depend on the horn lengths of the dads. It depended on how much food they got as larvae. So that meant, to use the jargon, that these weapons are a phenotypically plastic trait. It means that each animal has the potential to produce either a big horn or no horn. And that what that animal does depends on the environment that it encounters.
So it's not really predetermined.
So within kids that are all siblings, they share the same parents, the ones where I gave them poor nutrition all grew small and had no horns, and the ones that are full siblings, their relatives, that had lots of food all grew large and produced the horns. So that means then, what I'm inferring from that is that individual larvae have the potential to develop into either outcome. And what happens depends on circumstance.
So what did those findings lead you to do next?
That led to some questions of how do horns evolve then? If there's no heritability, if there's no resemblance between fathers and sons, what kinds of genes would contribute to variation in horn length? And if there's no genetic variation for horns, then evolutionary theory tells us these things can't evolve. They can't change over time. Yet you look across species and they clearly have changed a lot over time. So that was the paradox that I was facing at that time, is what's going on?
So what is going on?
Well, what's going on is we had to change our worldview. We had to look at the problem differently. I was thinking in terms of horns, big horns being sort of one genetic type and small horns being another genetic type, and that was wrong. That's not how it works. Instead, what happens is horns are this plastic thing, this endpoint of development. And what happens is there's a developmental mechanism that senses the nutritional state of that animal and responds accordingly. And that mechanism is really what I needed to study. So the other way of saying that is there, it's a threshold trait. If you grow past a threshold or a critical body size, you do one thing. If you don't make it past that critical size, you do another.
Tell me more about these threshold traits.
Well, threshold traits, once you're used to thinking about them, make a lot of sense. They're intuitive. But until you're used to thinking about them, they can be tricky. And so the way I try to explain it is, think back to a traditional thermostat on the wall. And it works best if you think back to the older type of thermostats, not the digital ones that everybody has these days. But they actually work the same way. You have a thermostat on the wall. A thermostat is a threshold. It's a threshold trait, and it's no different mechanistically from the kinds of threshold traits I'm talking about with the horns of these beetles. What a thermostat does is it responds to variation in the environment, which is the temperature in the room. And it has a threshold, it has a set point. And so if it's controlling heating fans or cooling fans, whichever one it's wired to, the idea then is if it's cooling fans, when the temperature rises above a threshold, above that set point, the fans click on, boom. If the fans then cool the room down, well, if the room temperature drops below that set point, then the fans turn off. And it's a very simple mechanism. It turns the fans on or off, but it does so in response to a continuously varying environment out there, which is the temperature of the room. The room can vary all over the place in terms of temperature, but the threshold senses that and couples it with a set point and results in another trait, which is the fans, being either on or off. Well, developmentally, that's what's going on in the beetles, is that they either produce the horns or they don't. So the horns are the equivalent of the fans. They're either on or off. And the analogy of temperature in this case is nutrition and body size. So how big you are, which depends on nutrition. If you grow bigger than a set point, a threshold body size, then the horns are on. They grow. If you don't reach that set point, then the horns stay off. And they don't grow.
And you can change that set point?
if you decide you want your room colder or warmer, you can change the thermostat. There's a, at least there used to be a little lever on the side. You can slide that lever up or down and you change the set point. And that's a crucial link to understanding a threshold trait. A threshold trait takes something like the fans and turns it on or off. The fans are discrete. They're either on or off. But the set point can vary, and it can vary continuously. You can slide it all the way down to a really cool temperature, all the way up to a hot temperature, and you can adjust when that thermostat switches between those two states by sliding that lever. Well, that was the frame shift we had to make with the Beatles. Once we realized that this is a threshold trait, then we had to look for that little lever on the side.
How did you do that?
We had to say, okay, is there variation in the set point? Do these families of beetles differ in how sensitive they are to nutrition? So some of them switch at a small size, and some of them switch at a medium size, and some of them switch at a bigger size. That's exactly analogous to saying, okay, in your household, your temperature thermostat might be set at 72 degrees, and in my household, the thermostat might be set at 68 degrees. There's variation among houses and where that set point is set at. Well, we looked for genetic variation among the beetles for where that set point was set at.
Did you find that genetic
variation? Yes, we did. So I was able to use what we call an artificial selection experiment. I could rear these animals in the lab, and I could deliberately breed individuals that had a set point that seemed to be at a large body size, and keep breeding those generation after generation. And in a separate set of lines or pools of animals, I could select each generation the ones that seemed to switch at the smallest body sizes and do that generation after generation. And after 7 generations of iterating this process, I was able to make the population diverge.
What do you mean?
I could end up with a population of beetles that on average switched to horns at a small size, and another population of beetles that on average switched to horns at a large body size. So I was able to show from an artificial selection experiment that there's genetic variation for that switch point.
Interesting. That's fascinating.
Yeah, so there is genetic variation for horns. It just wasn't where we were looking. It wasn't where we thought it was.
So what kind of research questions did that lead to?
I wanted to know what that mechanism was. What's that thermostat do? How does it work?
So how did you answer those questions?
I went and did a postdoctoral research fellowship at Duke University with an insect developmental biologist named Fred Nyhaut, who's also a really good evolutionary biologist. So he was a perfect intellectual environment for me to work with because he knows both fields, developmental biology and evolutionary biology. And I basically showed up on his doorstep with the beetles, brought the beetle system to his lab and said, let's figure out how they develop. And we spent a number of years trying to work out the hormones and the links, the things that couple nutrition with patterns of horn growth. And that research carried with me then to a faculty job at Montana, where we've now taken it to the level of starting to look at genetic cascades and physiological processes like the insulin signaling pathway, and sort of extending from that line of research to bring greater and greater precision to the mechanisms that are associated with that switch point of turning horns on or turning horns off.
And does that have implications for human nutrition?
The fact is that the beetle research that we do isn't motivated by addressing any particular agricultural or economic or health situation that we face as humans. That said, the lessons that we've learned are invaluable for understanding ourselves and the world around us and diversity in general that we see in the world around us. So we're looking at the fundamental mechanisms that are associated with how you get diversity in animal form. And we're comparing these mechanisms in different lineages of beetles. So we're doing it right now in the mandibles of stag beetles and in the horns of rhinoceros beetles and in the horns of dung beetles. And these are very different lineages of scarab beetles that have been separate from each other for 150 million years. And yet they all have sort of independently arrived at huge weapons that the males use in these types of fights. And we're looking for commonalities, for similarities, and for differences in the ways that these things develop and the types of sort of genetic processes that are involved in each case. In so doing, we're learning about how changes in animal form take place. And there's lots of parallels. I won't be surprised at all if we find that the mechanisms that we're studying are pretty similar to things that they're learning about dog breeds now and how you get one kind of dog shape over another, or basically changes that we're seeing in fisheries where you change life history parameters and body sizes and behavior, mating behaviors in fish as a consequence of aquaculture or different types of fishing or selective regimes. And so the processes that we're studying are fundamental. And the other thing is the pathway, the actual mechanism that we spend the most time thinking about, which has to do with the insulin receptor and insulin signaling, that pathway also applies to humans. So insulin is a really hot mechanism these days because insulin has been implicated in some of the studies on aging. And so when you look at senescence and at why you can raise fruit flies, for example, that senesce earlier or later than others, that die at younger or older ages, and some of these differences seem to be driven by activities of the insulin signaling pathway. And we know that the insulin pathway is very tightly coupled with metabolic syndrome in humans and potentially with obesity and with diabetes. So we know that it has to do with homeostatic regulation of carbohydrates and sugars. And again, I'm not an expert on the human physiology side, but it's the same pathway. It's the same genes and the same sets of interactions among the genes that are also regulating the role of nutrition and growth in insects. So again, I have to be honest, that's not why we're doing it. We're doing it because we want to understand diversity and we want to know how it is that these animals can do the things that they do. But the mechanisms that we're studying are likely to be relevant. And I won't be surprised at all if we learn things from the dung beetles that teach us something important about ourselves.
I know you've had a lot of adventures in collecting them and that these beetles have taken you, you know, all over the world. You had mentioned that they're found on 5 continents and that they've taken you, you know, Panama, Ecuador, Australia.
You would not believe the looks that I get. Remember that first impression phenomenon, right?
Right.
The initial reaction to dung beetles is revulsion. You have to get past that before they realize, wow, those are actually pretty cool.
Well, so you don't pretend you're going out on safari and then, like, get
out.
Try
carrying a bunch of live dung beetles back as a carry-on on an airplane. Having to explain what exactly it is that you're carrying onto that flight, you have to declare it because you don't want them to run it through the x-ray. If they run it through the x-rays, you've got a bunch of sterile beetles and you're not going to get them to breed for you when you get back to the lab. So you have to be able to pass these things around security and you get the most interesting reactions. Now, most of the time, they freak out and you've got to go through permits. We do have all kinds of USDA permits for legally importing these things, by the way. You can't just go around the world collecting live animals and expect to bring them back to the States. It's both illegal to export them from their native countries and illegal to import them into ours. But even when you have all the permits, you very often get caught in these quagmires of red tape and lose your shipments. But the looks I have gotten from the security people on the airlines are absolutely priceless.
What has been the strangest reaction that you've gotten?
I think the strangest reaction I got was one time coming back from Africa. We'd run out of the alcohol that we'd brought over with us to collect the beetles into, and getting high concentration ethyl alcohol turned out to be really hard to do where we were in the field. And so I desperately needed to package some of these beetles because we need to preserve them in alcohol, both so they're dead, because the permits we had for Africa were for bringing back only preserved specimens at that time, and also to preserve the DNA so that we could extract DNA from some of these species. So I needed them in alcohol, and we were short of alcohol, so we went to the duty-free shop and bought one of these bottles of Everclear, which is pretty high-proof ethyl alcohol. And then I sat there in the lavatory at the airport transferring all these beetles into this bottle of Everclear. So I had it essentially packed solid with dung beetles and sealed it up again and then threw it in my bag because you're allowed to carry, it's duty-free, one certain volume. I can't remember what the limits are, but you're allowed to carry a bottle of alcohol on the airplane. And so the look I got was when they inspected my bag and pulled out this jug of Everclear and it was absolutely packed solid with dung beetles. That, I think, was the most surprised reaction I've ever gotten. But anyway, no, we do have all kinds of adventures, and sometimes it's not glamorous. I mean, the simple fact is when you're looking for dung beetles, you put on a bunch of surgical gloves and you go out into pastures and poke around it with a shovel in the manure, and there's far more glamorous ways to make a living. But you meet some amazing people when you do that. So I've had some incredible conversations with property owners and farmers all over the world. They're always friendly, incredibly generous. They all think you're nuts, right? I mean, they think, here's this loco from the States. Well, whatever, he's not doing any harm. Might as well let him go. But once you get people talking, you learn, I've met some wonderful people doing that.
How about day-to-day adventures?
The most common ones are getting charged by bulls, because cattle pastures typically have bulls. And depending on where you are, these things can be really aggressive. So I've had people working for me actually get struck, charged by bulls. I've had some really close calls sprinting as fast as I can and leaping at full, you know, leaping over fences with these things charging after us. And I had to scramble up trees and wait for the bulls to change their mind and go away. So you're sort of working on the ground on one hand and looking up over your shoulder all the time with the other to make sure that these guys aren't inching too close.
So do you hire lookouts or something?
I had to do that once. When we were in the Serengeti on a field course that Montana teaches there, we had gotten permits to collect in the Serengeti Park, and they really do not like you to get out of vehicles for some very good reasons in East Africa, because there are lots of predators and things out there that will gladly kill you, and it's not so good for the tourist industry if the tourists get whacked. So we had guards with us. They were part of our entourage, and they, you know, they were part of our group and helping us with the camps at night. But yeah, for the trip in the Serengeti, we had armed guards posted on the top of the vehicle scouting while we went out into the surrounding areas by the road looking for dung and collecting beetles. And they really were calling the shots from the roof, telling us how close the Cape Buffalo were and at what point we should drop everything and run back to the truck.
In some of the forests that you've worked, like in Ecuador, you know, are you hiking through forests or traveling through them in canoes? Or
yes and yes, depends on where you are. So some of the places we've collected in Ecuador are pretty hard to get to. We had to fly in a little tiny airplane to Coca, a little frontier town, and then take a dugout canoe, and then you get met at the end by trucks that take you into the field station. But it depends on where you are. I spent most of my time working with the Smithsonian Institution, the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, STRI, in Panama. And so I actually spent over 2 years of my dissertation period as a graduate student living on Barra, Colorado Island in Panama, doing research on the beetles. And yes, I was out in the forest every single morning.
Tell me about that field work.
That was awesome. I would wake up in the mornings. It was a neat ritual that I had. I had to find howler monkeys to find the beetles, because the beetle that I was working on fed on the dung from howler monkeys. And howler monkeys are pretty common, but when you have to find them like clockwork every day, it gets hard. And I was having trouble, and finally the local Panamanian guides that were helping a primatologist, Katie Milton, that was working out there, took me aside and told me their secret. They said, "Oh no, you smell them." And I laughed. I thought they were teasing me, but they were serious. They taught me how to smell the monkeys.
Oh, really?
And so I would often find them by smell. I could run through the forest until I came across the smell and stopped dead in my tracks. And once I could smell them, I knew I was close. And then I could start sort of changing my search pattern and looking in the forest that way. But the other way I found them is howler monkeys are very predictable. Once a day, before dawn, in the dark, right before sunrise, they always do a dawn chorus, when they all sort of bellow out and do their howls and sort of announce to the different groups where they all are. I guess it has to do with territorial behavior on the part of the monkeys, but it was great for me. I would wake up in the dark in my room, which had screen on all sides. I'd sort of sit up in bed at exactly the right time and sit there in the dark and listen for the howls and take a compass bearing. As soon as they howled, I could estimate the distance and I'd take a compass bearing, and then I'd go back to sleep for another hour until it got light. And as soon as it was starting to get light, I would just take that compass bearing and I would run through the forest, sort of off trail, scrambling through the forest in the direction that the calls had come from until I smelled them. And once I smelled them, I knew I was there. And I could find the tree where the monkeys had roosted for the night. And when they'd get up and leave that tree and go foraging for the day, that's when all the dung would rain down and that's when all the beetles would come in. So I'd spend my mornings, morning after morning, watching the sunrise in a tropical forest. It was a pretty special way to undertake a dissertation.
So what do howler monkeys smell like?
What you're smelling is actually the dung. And it doesn't smell like you think. It's actually surprisingly pleasant. It smells like fermented leaves.
Hmm.
It's a sweet smelling, pungent. I mean, honestly, it smells like somebody's making beer and fermenting leaves. And I think the reason in this case is that particular species of monkey, they're hindgut fermenters, which means that they're not very efficient. A cow, for example, ferments in their foregut, if I'm not mistaken, and they've got like four different stomachs and they're extremely efficient at extracting everything. And that means from a dung beetle's perspective, what comes out the other end of a cow isn't all that great as far as dung is concerned, because the cows are very good at extracting everything that they need. The monkeys feed on fruits part of the year and on leaves a lot of the rest of the year, and they're not as efficient at digesting leaf material. And they still have gut microbes that help break it down, but they're not located in the foregut, the beginning of the gut. They're located at the end, in the hindgut. So things don't really start to get broken down until the monkey is basically done passing the food through its GI tract. they don't get as much out of the leaves, and that means that a lot more of the nitrogen and the nutrients that the beetles need are still in it by the time it comes out as dung. So what you're smelling is basically partially composted leaf material, and it really wasn't bad at all. But once you learn the smell, you could find them. And the trick then is, you know, tourists come down to the tropics and they've read all these horror stories of chiggers and ticks and all these crazy insects, and they don't want to get diseases. And so they cover themselves in long sleeves and long pants, and they'll tape their ankles all the way to their knees with duct tape, and then they'll dust themselves with sulfur powder, and then they'll spray themselves with insect repellent. And I don't know how you can smell anything in the forest when you look like that. But once you get used to the tropics and you realize that that's a lot of hype. You know, I would go out there in shorts and a t-shirt, and I never ever used any type of insect repellent, and I never used any strong smelling lotions or anything like that. And then your sense of smell can be pretty sensitive, and I could smell peccaries. I could always find peccaries by smell. You could usually smell the coatis once you learn their smell, and I could almost always find the howler monkeys by smell.
Wow. And so when you found the howler monkeys, you weren't actually looking for the howler monkeys because they would have left already. Is that right?
From where they had. And I'm going to take that on a twist. That isn't where you're expecting me to go. Uh-huh. That's a very good point. By the time I found the monkeys, well, I was doing it early in the morning, so I usually did find them. They'd usually still be hanging out in the trees, and they'd rattle and throw stuff at me and yell at me before they'd move on their way. But I was truly there for the dung because that's where the beetles came. But I needed to find that sort of morning drop when the dung arrived, when the monkeys left their roost tree, because that's where all the beetles would go. So I had to be there at the right time of day. But you mentioned a point that's key here. If you were a monkey predator, you wouldn't use smell to find the monkeys. You wouldn't find the dung to find the monkeys, because most of the time, by the time you find that, the monkeys are gone. So predators don't generally cue in on dung as a way to find their food. For that very reason, deer, antelope, anything like that, by the time you find the dung, the animal's not there anymore. But sloths are different. And I mentioned sloths a little while earlier. Sloths have this really slow physiology. And I'm one of these sort of type A, high-strung personalities. If I watch a sloth walk, it's excruciatingly painful for me to watch. I mean, I just go nuts. I'm out of my skin. I cannot imagine an animal moving that slowly. It just hurts to watch how slowly these things walk. There was one time when a young sloth, its branch broke in a windstorm, and it fell out of its tree and landed in the clearing in the lab near the cabin where I do all my research. And so here was this sloth that had fallen out of the tree. And I had my camera at that time all the way down at like 150 steps in a locker in a different part of the island. But the sloth moved so slowly. I had time to go all the way down, get my camera, come all the way back up, and the sloth had made it maybe a meter in its attempt to crawl to the edge of the clearing. And so I got down on my hands and knees, and it just kept coming right toward me. And I got all these amazing pictures of this sloth coming closer and closer to me. I was so psyched, because you don't see that very often.
Yeah.
I found out the next day I didn't have any film in my camera.
Oh, no!
Before the days of digital cameras, and my camera had been empty, and I missed it. Never had another chance to do that again. But the tangent is relevant, because sloths do an interesting thing when they go to the bathroom.
What is that?
A sloth moves so slowly that its dung actually could be used by predators as a way to find it. Because a predator that came into the smell of dung would still find the sloth. They are so slow that they would not have made it very far by that point. And so they are actually vulnerable to the smell of their dung, unlike most other animals. And so the sloths have this elaborate protocol. They essentially climb all the way down a tree, which is not trivial. For a sloth, that probably takes, I don't know, 6-8 hours. It takes a long time. They climb down the tree, they dig a hole, and they go to the bathroom in the hole, and then they cover it immediately. And this is thought to be an adaptation that lets them minimize the chances of being eaten by predators that would smell the dung. Sort of an interesting twist, but that's why the dung beetles ride on the back of the sloth. So if you're a dung beetle and the dung gets buried, there's no smell. How are you going to find it? So the way they find it is by actually riding around on the back of the sloth. And then when the sloth digs its hole, the dung beetles hop off, go down into the hole, lay their eggs in the sloth dung, and then climb back up on the sloth and wait for the next time. And that's why there are specialist dung beetles that have hooks on their legs and they ride around in the fur of the sloth. The same thing happens with koalas. Koalas are the Australian equivalent of a really slow physiology animal that moves just excruciatingly slowly, they have the same problem, if I'm not mistaken, with their dung being a cue to predators. And so they also bury their dung. And that's why the beetles ride on the koalas as well. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's a twist.
It's not real to what I'm saying, but it's a neat twist of dung beetles again. Another reason to get past the revulsion and to look at the intricacies of their biology.
Does that mean that the dung beetles that are cued for, you know, the specialist for sloths and koalas end up getting fresher dung because they're like right there?
Probably not, actually, because even the howler monkey dung specialist can get there within 15 seconds or 30 seconds. And within about 30 minutes, you'd probably have 3,000 or 4,000 beetles in an area where there's monkey dung. They get there fast.
Okay, so that doesn't give them some sort of advantage.
Right. But the advantage they get is lack of competition. See, the problem most dung beetles face is that there's all these other insects that come into the same food source and fight with them over it. And the sloths are able to get around that competition because they're pretty much the only ones at the right place at the right time. So it's not a matter of getting there when it's fresh. It's a matter of getting there and then getting buried so that nobody else finds you. That's the real ticket to the success of those beetles, I think.
You said dung beetles find their food using smell. Do they use their sense of smell for other things aside from finding food?
The answer is probably yes. There's some anecdotal evidence that suggests that they do actually communicate with each other using chemical signals like that. So one of them is that they live in tunnels. So a lot of the fighting and everything happens in tunnels. What that also means is it happens in the dark. So one of the things you might assume is that these weapons are big visual signals that they would use, but they're not. Because most of the time when the beetles encounter each other, they're doing it in total darkness in these tunnels underground. And so an awful lot has to do with tactile sensation. And as I mentioned earlier, they've got pads of hairs on the bottoms of their feet and on the undersides and around their mouth parts. So what happens when two beetles encounter each other in a tunnel, it's like a male can't tell who he's bumped into, whether it's the female or a rival male, until he actually comes into contact with them. And then what happens is they'll get sort of inverted respective to each other, and they'll each run their forelegs like a dog trying to dig in the ground, but they'll run those over the face of the other beetle, and instantly they react. So if it's a female, then the male will immediately turn around and try to mate with the female. If it's a male, he'll instantly elicit aggression and start to push that beetle out of the tunnel. So if you watch these things unfold in the ant farms, it's really clear that they don't essentially decide what to do with the other beetle until they touch it. And that's indicative. That suggests strongly that there's some kind of a chemical cue that they're using to tell if it's a male or a female or something about that individual. The other thing is that Armin Mochick, who also, he's at Indiana University, also does a bunch of work on these beetles, found a number of years ago when he was watching these beetles in the ant farms, he noticed something that I'd never managed to notice or pay attention to before. But these beetles, when they fly, they have two sets of wings. The first pair of wings are these really leathery covers that are called the elytra in beetles. And then the hind wings are really papery, and those are the transparent big ones that come out and actually power the flight, that they actually fly with. So in order for a beetle to fly, they pull the elytra to the side, like wings on an airplane, and then they can start unfolding and then flapping their real wings, which are the hind wings that they use to fly. Well, what Armin noticed is that these beetles are unusual in that when they're in the ground, underground, they actually can open their elytra a little bit, pull their hind wings out, and then close the elytra again afterwards. So they look like a turtle again. But now their papery wings are out, and they'll fan them. They'll flap them inside the tunnels. And the only reason we can think of that they would be doing that would be to provide some sort of ventilation. It's as if the male has a chemical signal that he's fanning towards the female, or else vice versa, he's trying to essentially pull the smell of the female towards him. So we don't know exactly how they use them or what these things are yet, but it's almost certain that there's some interesting level of communication going on that involves scents and smells to these insects.
You've inspired me now to go out to the pasture in my backyard.
Excellent. Go do it.
And find some new dung, which I'm sure I'll find very quickly since there's cows out there.
You are in the home of Ben and Jerry's. It's a good place for dung beetles.
So what can I expect to find? What should I do?
The first thing I will tell you is the best bet you have is to find an organic farm that doesn't treat their cattle with ivermectin or abamectin or any of these treatments that they use, because the medications that they give these animals can kill the dung beetles. And so you'll end up finding way lower levels of beetles in pastures where the cattle have been treated with basically pesticide equivalents of things like ivermectin than you will in an organic type farm. So find the right piece of property first. Dairy farms work great. And when you go look around in the dung, don't go for the really old cow manure that's all moldy and dried, because it's a mess and it'll be full of mites and it won't have the kind of beetles that you're looking for. And you don't want to find stuff that's so fresh that it's really gnarly and nothing has had time to get there yet. But if you can figure out how to find cow pads or horse manure that's about a day or so old, usually those are perfect. And you can take a trowel and flip it over. The beetles will be right against the ground. Right sort of at the underside of the dung and next to the top of the soil. And there's a really neat species in the genus I study, in Ontophagus, that should be there and should be fairly common in your pastures. It is not a native species. It's a European species. It's called Ontophagus nutchicornis.
What's it look like?
It has a really cute little unicorn horn. So the males have a single horn at the back of their head, sort of between their eyes and rising up from their head. It starts out kind of wide and flat, and then it narrows to a point in the middle. And they're a really neat color, too. The elytra, the backs of these beetles, are sort of an olive spotted color. So it's a really pretty beetle that you have out there in your pastures.
And how did it get here if it's a European species?
Good question. There seem to be stable populations in the Northeast, like around you, and also stable populations in the Northwest, so near Montana, near where I am. And they must have been introduced from Europe, and my guess is back in the 60s or 70s, and I'm going to guess it was accidental, but I actually don't know.
You had mentioned earlier about your experiment in trying to create horns for some beetles to test whether the shape made a difference, whether you could get them to fight. And I wanted to take us through that, you to take us through that thinking process and what
sure.
that experiment was and how you actually could even possibly go about fashioning some horns
sure.
to put on a dung beetle, even though it failed. I know the experiment didn't really work, but.
So let me step back for a minute and give you a little bit more of the logic in the big picture. If you look at cervids, or you look at the deer group, or you look at ungulates in general, the bovids, the cows and the sheep, there's an incredible variety of weapon types in those animals too. So any hunter will tell you that white-tailed deer antlers are different from mule deer antlers, and those are different from elk antlers. So what I'm saying is that these groups of animals, like the deer, have a lot of variation among species in the shapes of the weapons. And the same holds true for the old world antelopes as well. You've got incredible variations between kudu and ibex and impala and waterbuck and Thompson's gazelles and little tiny dick-dicks. And even when you get into other parts of the old world, there's like the Chinese water deer that actually have fangs. They've got tusks coming out of their jaws. And so they actually have weapons that are fangs instead of in the typical antlers that we're used to thinking. So there's all kinds of variation in weapon form. Well, there have been a number of people that have spent years thinking about why those species differ in weapon shape. And a lot of the answer, to the extent that they understand it, has to do with changes in habitat. As these animals moved into different types of habitats, so are they fighting on rocky cliffs like bighorn sheep and ibex, or are they fighting in the dense understory of forests, or are they fighting out in the open in pastures? The habitats that these animals were fighting in changed as these species diversified, and they argue so did the nature of the fights. What it takes to win a fight on a cliff is different from what it takes to win a fight in a dense forest understory, and that's different from what it takes to win a fight in open pastures. And so one of the things that might have led to variation in weapons is differences in the habitats in which they're fighting. They also found differences in the way that the animals fought, and some of these arguments have to do with body size. Small animals and big animals face different sort of constraints, if you will. When they move, they're differentially agile. Big animals are much clumsier. They are damaged more significantly if they fall. And so you ended up having, they argue, changes from fights that are swift, quick lunges with sharp, deadly weapons to things in much bigger species that are much more associated with bluster and bluff and sort of strength contests where you push. And they don't rely on the really quick maneuvering or the agility that these big animals no longer have. Where I'm going with this is just that to the extent that people have thought about why weapons differ, the arguments all hinge on the habitats where these animals are actually fighting and on the styles of fights that are involved. Well, I tried to apply that logic to the dung beetles. I wanted to know why the weapons differ in the dung beetles, and that was the good place to start. And I started looking at the different habitats. Well, they live on every continent except Antarctica. They live in habitats from extreme desert Australian outback to lush tropical forest to the sides of mountains. I mean, they live in every possible habitat type you could imagine. They feed on every kind of dung you can imagine. I mean, literally, if it walks on two or four legs and produces dung in any kind of respectable quantity, there's probably a species in this genus that feeds on it. So they have all this ecological diversity in where they live and what they do. That was perfect. That set the stage. Well, are there certain types of horns in deserts or certain types of horns in the rainforest? And maybe I could find patterns like that.
And did you?
The problem came when you look closely at what they do. The horns are always used in the same setting. They're used inside tunnels. So it doesn't really matter if you're a dung beetle, whether you're in the Australian outback or in a tropical forest. You dig a tunnel, you're in a tunnel, you fight over a tunnel. And so on the surface, there's all this rich diversity in behavior and biology. And then when you actually look at it closely from the perspective of the beetles and the weapons, well, they're all fighting over a tube, a dark cylindrical tube in the ground. And it doesn't really matter what continent you're on or what habitat you're in or what you feed on. It's still a dark cylindrical tube. And so I had this problem, which is, wow, there's all this amazing diversity in weapons, and yet, oops, they're all fighting over the same kind of setting in the same circumstances everywhere. So then I started saying, well, maybe there's different kinds of fights. Maybe they have some ritualized kind of fight in some species where they lock together in one way, and a different kind of ritualized fight in another species, and they lock together in that way. And as I already told you, we didn't find that. The fights are chaos. I mean, I look at 10 fights in one species and there's nothing similar about them at all. Try to compare that to another species and there's no pattern. I mean, the fights are too chaotic. And so we looked at the habitats and failed. We looked at the types of fights and failed. I was really starting to scratch my head and wonder, well, why are these weapons so diverse? I understand why they're big. Bigger's always better than small. But why would they change from a pair of horns on the head to one horn, like the unicorn beetles you have near you? Or why would they change from that to a horn on the thorax? We were really coming up empty. And so I started trying to actually stage fights. One of the things that you could suggest is that if animals have one kind of weapon, there could be an advantage to novelty per se. So a new type of weapon might work if it's just different. Or it could be the opposite. It could be that a new type of weapon's disastrous and actually you need to have the same kind of weapon that the other guy has if you're going to actually be able to fight. If you come up with something different, you lose. So there were fun questions like that. There's also the argument that, well, maybe you've got one horn, but it's better to have two. So if you could have an animal that has twice the number of horns, maybe they do better than an animal that has one big horn. And so there's fun sort of scenarios that could explain why a mutation or a change, an evolutionary change in weapon form might do well and might spread. And that kind of a process could spread out over all these different species of beetles over 40 million years. That kind of a phenomenon could give you lots of diversity. So in order to look at that, I had to stage fights. And I had to stage fights with beetles with different types of weapons. And that's where we started getting out the glue.
Was it easy?
The problem is the beetles are really tiny and they fight inside tunnels, so it's really hard to watch anyway. And these darn things break off. We weren't able to get them to stay on very well. And you have to cut off horns too, because you got to get rid of the other kind of horn if you're going to put on a different kind of horn. And we were clumsy and sloppy at it. We never were able to pull it off, despite some really gifted hands, not just mine. We had other people in the lab, students that were really good at doing surgeries, trying to do these things. And it was not some of our more glorious moments.
I mean, it seems like you'd need to be a surgeon just to cut off the horns of such a tiny...
Yeah, or you can snap them off with a pair of wire cutters and then file it down a little. I mean, it's a little bit brutal. What I got to say now, we also are working on rhinoceros beetles now. And those are actually a really different lineage of beetles. They're not dung beetles. They come from a different subfamily of beetles, the Dynastinae. They're much bigger. So the beetles that we're rearing in the lab right now are probably 3 to 4 inches long as adults, including their horns. And the horns themselves are almost 2 inches long. And a horn that big, we really can remove. We can do it delicately. We can patch up the wounds. We can try to glue these things on. And so I have a graduate student who's studying flight in these beetles and looking at what it's like to fly with a pitchfork in front of your face. And she's measuring drag and looking at air turbulence and literally measuring the metabolic cost of a male flying with a weapon. She's going to be doing a lot of cutting off of horns and gluing them back on and changing their center of mass, so gluing them on different parts of the body and things like that. And we think we'll do a lot better with the big rhinoceros beetles just because they're much more tractable than the little teeny guys.
And what do you make the artificial horns with?
Well, we were trying to use other horns from other species. So we would act, it would be a beetle horn. We would take it off of one species, file it down, and try to glue it on another species.
But that might have But that might have implications for disabled beetles.
There are
at a
so
later...
many reasons that experiment was doomed. You're right. No, and it is true that especially with the bigger ones, we might be able to make an artificial horn out of some polymer or plastic that we would be able to mold onto there.
I wanted to close by asking you what's next for you, and how has your beetle research sort of influenced what you're working on now, which is broader research on, you know, animal weaponry.
With the dung beetles and with the rhinoceros beetles, the main research questions that we're focusing on at the moment, so what our current grant is for example, is to study the genetic and physiological pathways that couple nutrition with growth. And we're looking in particular at exaggerated growth. I mentioned a couple times in these interviews that I'm crazy about these animals with extreme traits. Things like a leg on top of your head. I mean, really big structures. And so to get a structure like that, you have to take something like a mandible or a leg or a new structure like a bump on your back and cause that structure to grow disproportionately rapidly so that over the same time window of development, that thing grows much faster than your eyes and your legs and your wings and everything else. And so we're trying to exploit that aspect of their growth to tease apart the genetics and the physiology behind super fast, exaggerated growth of structures. And so a big part of our lab research is focused on that. But the weapons part in general has led me into some other arenas that are fun.
Can you tell me about them?
I've spent a good part of the last year, and I'm going to spend a bunch of the rest of this year, working on a trade book. So a book aimed at non-scientists about the fun of animal weapons. And it's going to be called something like Animal Weapons, The Stories Behind Nature's Most Magnificent Structures. And it has a chance to dive into the cool natural histories and the stories behind so many of the animals that have really extreme weapons, and to pull together common themes that have been learned from all the years of research on these different systems. Because there's a lot of things that antlers and deer and potentially the horns and triceratops, dinosaurs and spines on trilobites and tusks on wasps and all these different animals and claws or chelae and crabs, all these things have in common. There's a tremendous amount of similarity across all these different groups of animals. And so this book is a chance to pull the stories of these animals together and to try to draw some general themes and then turn and look at ourselves and look at our own military past and start examining like arms races and the Greek galleons and getting more and more oars and more layers until these ships were so big they basically broke apart and sank. Or arms races in ships of the line in Napoleonic era warfare. There's lots of episodes of weapon escalation and arms races in our past that have striking similarities to the patterns we see in animals. And there's patterns with the ways that we fight and sort of the chivalrous side of combat, like the tournaments that medieval knights used to get into, that have really fun parallels to sexual selection and mating systems and weapon evolution in animals. So one of my big projects is to try to pull together what we know from all these different cool animals and learn from it and glean from it something thought-provoking and reflective about ourselves. One other thing that I'm doing this year is teaming up with one of my favorite science writers, Carl Zimmer, who has just written a textbook called The Tangled Bank that is an evolution textbook aimed at non-majors, so aimed at a much broader audience than traditional textbooks are aimed at. And he brings all of the color and the vibrancy and the narrative style of a really good journalistic writer to the field of evolutionary biology. It's a fantastic book. And I have the opportunity this year to team up with him and with his publisher, Ben Roberts, to work on a sort of a more advanced version of an evolution textbook. So we've been having a really good time putting that together.
Well, that's fantastic. I look forward to hearing more about your research coming up. And I just wanted to end with a question is, if people want to learn more about these issues we've been talking about, it seems like this book you mentioned, it's called The Tangled Bank. Is that right?
Yes. Well, that would be a great introduction to evolutionary biology, which is the sort of the mother field that encompasses a lot of my research. It won't specifically deal with the dung beetles. But if you're interested in learning more about dung beetles, there also are some really good resources. So there's the ScarabNA Research Network, and ScarabNet is probably the easiest, S-C-A-R-A-B-N-E-T. So these are sort of centralized blogs and web pages that pull together resources on dung beetles, everything from taxon databases to species red list indices for conservation to learning how to figure out what's in your backyard. So I definitely encourage people to check out things like ScarabNet if they want to learn more about dung beetles.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for the interest.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about dung beetles with Doug Emlin, a professor of biology at the University of Montana and an expert on the evolution and development of bizarre and extreme shapes in insects. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of an insect found in the eastern United States that feeds on cow dung. It's typically black with blue or green hue and is about 11 to 20 millimeters long. Have an idea? In fact, it's a kind of dung beetle known as Egger's earth-boring beetle. Here's the sound of this interesting dung beetle.
Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.